Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on protests across Northwest Indiana. North Township Trustee Frank Mervan won the Democratic primary for the U.S. House District 1 seat. Darian Benson and Carter Barrett have a report on Black health disparities. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Ivy Tech Community College VP of Academic Admissions, Dr. Russ Baker, about a guaranteed admissions agreement with Indiana University. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Representative Pete Vasilowski's choice to replace him after 36 years in Congress won the Democratic primary in the party's Northwest Indiana stronghold. Frank Mervan, a Lake County Township trustee whose father is a longtime state senator from Hammond, won Tuesday's primary over 13 other candidates. Five-term Hammond Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. entered the campaign as the most prominent candidate, but Mervan picked up endorsements from Vasilowski and the United Steelworkers Union. Mervan will be a heavy favorite in the November election against Republican primary winner Mark Leyva, who's lost several times to Vasilowski.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Police on Thursday condemned racist social media posts about an upcoming community event commemorating the lives lost to police brutality at Central Park on Sunday, saying the post should not reflect on the town or its image. Griffith Police Chief Greg Mance said the department felt compelled to make a public statement after a local bar owner made posts that were racist and that implied anyone would be shot if he or she tried to loot her property during the event on Sunday. Many of the posts are unprintable memes, such as derogatory comments about Black children. The Times reports that police will be prepared but are not concerned that the gathering hosted by Black Lives Matter will boil over into looting or property damage. The organizer came to police to coordinate with them. Mance said police will be present to ensure that people can exercise their First Amendment rights and that there is no property damage or violence. Organizer Taylor Green invited the Griffith Police Chief to speak at the event, along with Black men and women who will discuss, quote, integration, equality, peace, and how to build trust within the community. Green stressed the gathering, which will take place from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Sunday, is a community event and not a protest. Organizers will have hamburgers, hot dogs, snacks, water, and Gatorade, and will help attendees register to vote. Griffith Town President Rick Rifa said the event was organized in cooperation with police and would be a good thing for the community.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Protesters in Crown Point who took to the streets Monday to condemn racism and police killings of Black people encountered bystanders who were holding rifles during the demonstration. The Post-Tribune reports a video circulated on social media showing 21 people standing along a bike trail near downtown Crown Point. Eight of those bystanders held firearms, an act Crown Point Police Chief Pete Land said is protected under law. Land explains, it is legal in Indiana to carry a rifle or shotgun, but a permit is required to carry a sidearm in public. Protests in St. John as well as Lowell on Thursday also included observers with rifles and other weapons.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
a Chesterton town councilman has resigned his seat after joking on Facebook that a friend who is a plow truck driver should, quote, straight blade protesters blocking his route to work. Chesterton town council member Bob Allison resigned Sunday, just moments after the town clerk treasurer released a statement from other councilors urging him to resign. The Chesterton Tribune reports that after protesters gathered Saturday in nearby Hammond to denounce police and the death in Minneapolis of George Floyd, Allison posted, quote, get the snowplows out, followed by, quote, straight blade them. Allison subsequently apologized on Facebook for the comments.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Crown Point Police Department made history on Wednesday by swearing in its first African-American police officer. Police Chief Pete Land said Officer Rob Harrell, badge number 115, is the department's first and only African-American officer. Chief Land said in an email, Rob stood out in the hiring process and showed himself to be the top applicant. The fact that after working in other law enforcement agencies away from Crown Point, and he chose to return to his hometown to live and help serve the community is something to be admired. He goes on to say, the department and the city is lucky to have him as part of the police officers' force. The Times reports Harrell was sworn in during an in-person ceremony at Crown Point Fire Rescue, which included city officials, family members, and his new squad car. The gathering was closed to the public. Prior to serving in Crown Point, Harrell was a correctional officer at the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City. He also was an Indiana State Capitol Police officer where he patrolled the Indiana State Capitol building. The Crown Point High School graduate says he's, quote, ready to rock and roll to do great things in the community while making it safe. Harrell later added, quote, I made history. I know I made history. I'm very proud of that for sure, that I'm the first African-American in the department. So it feels really good for sure. Harrell graduated from the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy in 2019.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
On Saturday, various vendors will return to the Crown Point Farmers Market at Bulldog Park. From 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., crafts, produce, and more will be available at the Open Air Market, which is held on Saturdays until late September. Similar to other markets in the area, the Crown Point Market will open with restrictions in place due to the coronavirus pandemic. Attendees and vendors will be asked to follow various guidelines. The city has asked anyone who is sick or has been in contact with someone who is or was ill or tested positive for COVID-19 in the past 2 weeks to avoid the market. Only 100 people will be allowed in the market at a time. The Times reports those attending should sanitize their hands before and after attending the market and maintain social distancing in line. Wearing a mask is highly recommended. Until social distancing restrictions are lifted, there will be one entrance exit from the market and seating won't be available for patrons. Shoppers are not allowed to consume products at the market, neither should they touch products until they have been purchased. Similar to shoppers, any vendors who appear sick should not attend the market. All vendors are asked to wear gloves and masks, and vendors will be spaced at least 10 feet apart. Vendors are allowed to serve one customer at a time. Food vendors cannot offer samples, and anyone cooking food on site is asked to package all meals to go. According to the city's website, anyone who doesn't follow the guidelines will be asked to leave the market.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana will test all nursing home employees for COVID-19 at least once in June to help understand who may have the virus without symptoms and help limit further spread. The initiative will help state officials understand who needs to be tested and how frequently. Indiana is also moving on to the second phase of a massive randomized COVID-19 testing study, a joint effort between Indiana University's Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health and the Indiana State Department of Public Health. Governor Eric Holcomb said the second phase is expected to test 5,000 people.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Another summer event is being put on hold. The Indiana State Fair will not happen this year. Organizers blame COVID-19. Sharon Smith is the communications director for the Indiana State Fair Commissions.
We won't have the full, robust Indiana State Fair as most people know it.
Youth working on projects have been preparing for the fair for months. Details on the 4-H livestock show are still in development. Smith says more will be known in the coming weeks, including whether the exhibitions will be open to the public.
Whether there will be additional components to support that, at this point, we don't know, but we do know that the show will focus on 4-H.
The livestock show will begin in August, weekends only. This year's cancellation is the first time the Indiana State Fair has been canceled since World War II. The fair's only other cancellation occurred during the Civil War.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Demonstrations are flaring up across the country to protest the deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police. But they're also calling attention to broader inequalities. One of those areas, health disparities, kills Black Americans in massive numbers. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson and Carter Barrett report.
Black residents of Marion County, where Indianapolis is located, are more likely to be infected with COVID-19 than white residents. They are also more likely to suffer from diseases like diabetes and kidney failure.
There's nothing about Black residents in Indianapolis in particular makes them more susceptible to the coronavirus. What it is it's sort of a result of so many layers of inequity.
This is Matt Nowlin. He co-authored a new report from Savvy, a program affiliated with the Polis Center at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
At the end of the day, these systemic inequities can be a life or death issue.
One result is a big difference in life expectancy. Researchers from Savvy and the Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health found a few years ago that people in a mostly white suburb lived to 83 years old on average. 15 miles south in downtown, where there are more minorities, the average was only 69. This pattern in Indianapolis holds true in cities across the Midwest and U.S. And though health issues aren't a focus of street protests, some experts say they contribute to the unrest.
We know that African-American, Latino patients and other minority patients are more likely to have poor living conditions on average. They're more likely to have issues with food insecurity. They're more likely to have access to non-healthy diets.
That's Dr. Curtis Wright, CEO of Eskenazi Medical Group, the city's safety net hospital. Some patients, he says, might be unaware they are high risk because of poor access to health care.
There's known to be lack of trust in medical providers regarding medications, education about certain conditions, and some preventive measures.
The Indiana Minority Health Coalition has been involved in these issues for years. Here's Vice President of Public Policy, Tony Gillespie.
We're one of the states with the lowest public health investment in the country. Well, you know, you really can't adequately address public health if you don't address social justice issues and social determinants of health.
Social determinants are factors like unsafe housing, lack of transportation, or scarce grocery stores. They all contribute to health problems and make solutions even more complex.
I think when things become just like part of the landscape, then people you no longer, it becomes deprioritized and nobody really pays attention to it. And then just becomes yet another issue that has to be addressed across the public health continuum.
Gillespie says the recent protests and outrage are in part a response to these historic inequalities.
I think those people, they are in the thick of it, so they know something is wrong. Do they attribute that to a public health issue? No, probably not. I think there are people who in public health don't necessarily make that connection.
But now many are asking what can be done. The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus is working to address disparities with COVID-19, and many local clinics offer special programming related to diabetes. The Minority Health Coalition wants the state to spend more money on health, and Wright, the Eskenazi CEO, sees a big opportunity in education. The American Cancer Society's Brian Hannon has lobbied lawmakers to make public health policy changes for years. He says change won't come easy.
We shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that this is a problem we can solve with one policy or with one conversation or with one campaign, and certainly not one legislative session or one budget cycle.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett reporting with Darian Benson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Ivy Tech Vice President of Academic Admissions, Dr. Russ Baker.
Ivy Tech Community College is joining with the IU regional campuses in a very special agreement that is going to be of interest to all Ivy Tech students who are looking at higher education beyond their classes at their Ivy Tech campus. Let's find out more about it here. We have from Indianapolis, the Vice President of Academic Affairs for the Ivy Tech Community College, Dr. Russ Baker, with us. And Dr. Baker, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about the thoughts and the work behind the new agreement that Ivy Tech Community College has basically just signed, which started out with the Indianapolis campus, but is now expanded to all regional campuses with IU.
That's exactly right, Chris. I'll try to be concise in my answer, but in essence, what we wanted to do is take away the lack of certainty for students who want to begin at Ivy Tech, who for a variety of reasons are interested in getting the first 2 years of their bachelor's degree with Ivy Tech, and then they want to transfer to one of the four-year institutions. And in this case, one of the four-year regional IU campuses. So that would include IU Northwest, obviously, up there in Northwest Indiana, but it also includes IU Kokomo and clear down IU Southwest or Southeast, et cetera. But what we wanted to do through this guaranteed admission agreement, Chris, is essentially provide students with a guarantee that if they meet certain criteria when they graduate from Ivy Tech, there's no question that they will be admitted. Their admission into the IU regional campus is, in fact, guaranteed. And at the end of the day, that's what this agreement does, is remove that lack of certainty.
How long would you say, in talking with your colleagues in the planning for this agreement, how long would you say that there's been discussion about the need to give Ivy Tech students an opportunity to make it easier for them, as well as for the universities, to be able to move them directly after they get their two-year degree, basically, I know for some, or general certificate, or however you want to consider it, to be able to go into study for a four-year degree? How much work has been involved, I guess, and how many years has it been? It seems that this has been really kind of in the planning stages, in a way.
Yeah, I'm kind of chuckling to myself because I was a history major growing up. That was my college degree, my master's degree. So sometimes my colleagues at Ivy Tech feel like I go too far into the history and too deep into the weeds on things like dates. So you're talking to my type of learning and my background when you ask a question like that. I'll try not to go too far into the weeds, but what I will say is that this has been worked on in various stages for more than 5 years. And some of my colleagues from other state universities have been a part of that. But what we've been working on for the last several years is a process where students who get their two-year degree in one of 18 different programs that are called transfer single articulation pathways TSAP can be sure that then when they transfer, all of that credit will transfer with them if they get accepted to the four-year university. So just to give a specific example, Chris, if a student wants to get a degree in criminal justice, and I'm using that as one of several examples I could give of a program area in this TSAP, they can get their Associate of Science degree from any of the Ivy Tech or Vincennes. Vincennes is included in this as well, just to be clear. They're not included in the Guaranteed Admission Agreement. That was an Ivy Tech initiative, but they are part of the TSAP program. A student can get their associate degree from Ivy Tech or Vincennes, and if they transfer to IU Northwest or another institution that has a criminal justice degree, they, for the last 5 years since the fall of 2015, they've been able to know that all of their credit will transfer seamlessly. Mm-hmm. What they haven't been assured of, frankly, is that they will be admitted to the four-year university, because that was a separate process. And essentially, that's what this agreement does, is it takes away that question mark for the student so that they know for sure that if they get a 2.5 in their associate degree at Ivy Tech and then want to go to IU Northwest to complete that degree, that their admission is guaranteed. So that's the real beauty of this, is it takes away that uncertainty. So a student, whatever age they may be, they don't have to be right out of high school, by the way, to take advantage of this. But if a student is wanting to enroll at Ivy Tech this fall, and then they want to go to one of the IU regional campuses to get their four-year degree, they can know from the very beginning that they're going to be able to be admitted into the four-year school without any question, as long as they get at least a 2.5 grade point average while they're with us at Ivy Tech.
That's great. Dr. Baker, is there any economic opportunities or savings, for that matter, that any Ivy Tech student that wants to follow through and to be able to apply for going to their following through on their education with IU, they'll be able to be able to benefit from, especially now with the finances being pretty tight with the pandemic and all?
Yes, for sure. And first of all, several of the state universities are beginning or already have put in place some pretty lucrative financial aid scholarship opportunities to encourage transfer students. There was a time when most financial aid dollars got directed towards incoming freshman students. And while that's probably still true to some extent, we've really seen four-year schools begin to step up and offer more incentives to students to transfer after their first 2 years. Because I think universities are seeing that, after all, those upper-level classrooms are usually the ones that are not as full. Even though most everything is being done right now virtually because of the COVID crisis, there's capacity at that junior and senior year, and so incentivizing students through scholarship is becoming more and more popular among the four-year institutions. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other piece I will mention is probably somewhat of a given, but the tuition level at Ivy Tech for the first 2 years is several thousand dollars less per year than it would be at a four-year institution. So conservatively, if a student wants to take the first 2 years at Ivy Tech and then transfer to a regional campus, they're going to save at least $6,000 off the tuition they would pay if they went to the four-year campus at the regional for the full 4 years. So there's a definite savings just in terms of the rack price of tuition between Ivy Tech and the four-year regional campuses.
Now, Dr. Baker, is there any place that anybody who's interested in what we've been talking about here, the Ivy Tech and the IU regional campuses agreement, can find out more about it and to be able to take advantage of it?
There sure is. I would say the first thing they should do, this agreement went into effect June 1st. So just earlier this week, this agreement is now officially in place. And so any student who is admitted into Ivy Tech in the fall in one of the programs that are covered could contact and should contact the Ivy Tech admissions office, and they can contact really any of the campus's admissions office, depending on which campus they want to attend. And that office, the folks there, the academic advisors there, can explain which programs are covered by the agreement. There's a lot of details that I know we don't want to get into on a conversation like this, but that are important to students. We have staff that are ready to have that conversation with students right now. And then it's important to make sure that people understand and that students and stakeholders understand this is a collaboration. So we want those students to also have conversations while they're at Ivy Tech with the four-year regional campus, maybe it's IU Northwest, mm-hmm. where they plan to transfer, so that they can continually get guidance on making sure that that transfer is seamless. And, of course, then we want the student to begin pursuing academic excellence and make sure they have that 2.5 GPA, which is what's required for this agreement to kick in.
Dr. Russ Baker is the Vice President for Academic Affairs at Ivy Tech Community College, and thank you very much for spending time going over this agreement, guaranteed admissions agreement, as it's called. Ivy Tech Community College is set up with all of the IU regional campuses, including taking advantage of IU Northwest. We appreciate you spending time, and we hope that a lot of students at Ivy Tech follow through on this, take advantage of this new agreement.
I appreciate it. Thanks again.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.